one, the hits. Be a boy, baby.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Alice Bryant and Jill Robbins. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Alice Bryant.
Have you ever been sure that you were pronouncing a word correctly, only to find out just how wrong you were? That happened to me on a trip to France a few years ago. I was at a cafe ordering food. When I said the word egg in French, the server did not understand me. After a few more tries, he still had no idea what I was trying to say. I was very surprised. That experience reminded me of something. Having too few chances to speak a language can leave us unclear about our pronunciation ability. Many of you out there can probably relate. You may have had trouble finding English practice partners in your own city or country. One answer is to use an app for pronunciation practice. While most such apps are imperfect, they may support your overall efforts to be better understood in English. On today's education tips, we will talk about 4 American English pronunciation apps. The first one is called Say It Pronunciation. This app's goal is to help learners improve the clarity of their pronunciation. It was developed by Oxford University Press, the same publishers that brought us the world's biggest dictionary. Users of Say It Pronunciation can practice more than 35,000 words. With the app, you can take a pronunciation test of words pre-chosen by the app from easy to difficult. Touch letters from the IPA to hear what each sounds like. Record yourself saying a word. The app then creates a waveform from your voice, and you can compare it to that of the model speaker. A marker shows which part of each word to stress. Play your recording at a slower speed to hear differences between your pronunciation and the models. And share your pronunciation recording with a friend or teacher. Say It Pronunciation offers a free version, but its usability is limited. You would need to buy the paid version to get full use of the app, which costs $6.99. Next up is the app Elsa Speak. Elsa Speak uses artificial intelligence, or AI, to act as your own American English pronunciation teacher. One of the strong points of this app is that it offers a speaking test with detailed results and a score. Another is that its AI software lets you have conversations with the computer and get feedback. With the app, you can take a speaking test to help you understand your biggest pronunciation problems. After the test, Elsa Speak puts together your personalized lesson plans. Listen to Elsa Speak, repeat its words or phrases, and get immediate feedback on how to move your lips and tongue for better sound clarity. 4 different types of lessons: pronunciation, listening, syllable stress, and conversation. And choose a time that you want to practice and get reminders from the app each day. Elsa Speak has a free 7-day trial version that lets you take the speaking test and use its 1,200 lessons. After that, you would need to pay for the full version. Prices range from 99 cents to $99 for in-app purchases. Next up is accent training, which was designed for iPad and can operate on an iPhone. It also has an Android version, which goes by the name American English Accent Guide. Both center on a few important elements of pronunciation, including reduced speech, intonation, and connected speech. With the app, you can practice listening to and using reduced speech. Read along as you listen to short passages and see in red which phrases are reduced. Try recording yourself reading the passages and compare your recordings to that of the model. And connect to other useful apps, such as VOA English Learning, which is not our app, but does use our content. The iPhone version offers 16 practices. The Android version offers a virtual conversation room. The app is free, but unwanted ads show up often. You can choose whether to pay $2.99 to remove them. And finally, we have English Pronunciation Tutor. On Android, the app is called American English Pronunciation Tutor. Developed by Language Arts Press, the app is useful if there are specific sounds in English that give you continuous trouble. With the app, you can focus on one element of pronunciation in each unit, see drawings and hear recorded explanations of the mouth shape and tongue positions that produce each sound, see pictures of similar sounds side by side and touch the pictures to compare how to produce each sound, record yourself saying words and compare yourself to the model, and take a listening quiz on the sounds of each unit. The app is free for the first unit only. After that, you would pay $5.99 to activate the full version. I'm Alice Bryant.
In a town near Indianapolis, Indiana, 19-year-old college student Grace Kern has been working in elementary school classrooms. She is helping students as teachers offer instruction online via a screen inside the room. "My dad told me that a bunch of teachers are out and they're struggling to get substitutes in. And I was like, well, all my classes are online except for one. So I have time to do it. And I would hate for the schools and the students to struggle," she said. Grace Kern is studying medical imaging technology at Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis. Her father is Scott Kern, a human resources director at Greenfield Central Community Schools. He asked the community for help as he watched the number of substitute teachers go down. "I said, if you've got a student who's in college, maybe they'd like to work even a 2-month thing for us, which would be a stopgap, no doubt, but it will help us a whole bunch. More than 12 college students answered the call, including Kern's own daughter. As the coronavirus makes large numbers of educators stay at home or stop working, school districts around the country are aggressively employing substitute teachers. The schools offer extra money and do not require the employees to have a teaching degree. They are doing all they can to keep classrooms open. Coming to the rescue in many cases are college students who are themselves learning online or home for long winter breaks. Before the pandemic hit, there was already a shortage of teachers. Fewer students became teachers, and retired teachers were staying home with health concerns. Teachers are now staying home because of contact tracing or exposure to the virus. This situation has made schools move to distance learning, even when they could have in-person classes. Governor Ned Lamont is the Democratic leader of the state of Connecticut. Late last month, he asked college students who were coming home for their winter break to help in hospitals, virus testing sites, and in schools. In cases where teachers are leading instruction from a distance, Lamont said college students could be paid to come into the classrooms and help provide supervision. "Look, you could binge watch Netflix for 3 weeks, but we have some other ways you could really be of assistance. Helping your entire community get through this pandemic," Lamont said at a news conference. Isabel Orozco is a freshman at Wellesley College. She is working as a substitute teacher in the Cheshire, Connecticut district, where she graduated high school in June. She said she's considering taking all of her spring term classes online so she can continue working in the public schools. "Anything I can do to help, I feel good about," she said. The temporary employer, Kelly Education, works with districts to provide substitutes. Company president Nicola Suarez said the pandemic has exposed problems with shortages that have been worsening for years. Suarez said the past 10 months have quickly made it worse, adding that she does not expect too much improvement next school year. "We've seen a lot of folks leave the profession. The openings are going to increase, so it is a domino effect," she said. In South Carolina, Lisa Osry of Charleston experienced this herself. One of her first jobs of the year was substituting for a teacher in his mid-60s who quit suddenly. He worked a couple of weeks and said, "I'm out of here," and walked out the door, she remembered. In Nebraska, more school organizations are asking the state government to excuse substitutes from a requirement to have a teaching certificate. That change lets administrators hire substitutes who have 60 college credits. The student must have completed a teaching class and another that deals with unfair treatment and discrimination. In Iowa, more substitute jobs are going unfilled, even after the state lowered its requirements. Coy Marquardt is Associate Executive Director at the Iowa State Education Association. He explained that in the past, schools could divide a missing teacher's students among the other teachers in the building. "But that will not work in a pandemic," he said. To deal with the teacher shortage, some administrators and counselors are serving as substitutes, although even that is not enough. That is one of the reasons why some of the districts went and are still in virtual or remote, because they just didn't have the staffing, Marquardt said. I'm Jill Robbins.
To help protect yourself against the new coronavirus, wash your hands for 20 seconds with soap and water before you eat, after using the toilet, and after touching anything many other people touch, like a seat on a public bus. If you cannot wash your hands with soap and water, use an alcohol-based hand sanitizer that contains at least 60% alcohol. Taking these steps can help prevent not only the new coronavirus disease, but also colds, flu, and other viruses. For more information, visit the following websites: the World Health Organization at www.who.int, or the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention at www.cdc.gov.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. The 1880s were years of important change in American business and industry. 20 years after the Civil War, the United States had become one of the leading industrial nations of the world. As the number of factories increased, so did competition between businesses. Some industrialists cooperated with their competitors to reduce competition. But this did not always succeed. There was no legal way to enforce their agreements. Leo Scully and Jack Weitzel tell how these issues were handled during the administration of President Benjamin Harrison.
In 1879, a new form of business organization was developed, the trust. In a trust, stock owners of many competing companies give control of their stock to a committee or group of trustees. The trustees operate all the companies as one and pay profits to the stockholders. The profits would be high because there would be no competition to drive down prices. One of the first trusts was formed by John D. Rockefeller in the oil industry. The stockholders of 77 oil companies gave control of their stock to 9 trustees of Rockefeller's Standard Oil Company. The 9 men controlled 90% of the nation's oil production.
The success of the Standard Oil Company led to the creation of trusts in other industries. Soon, there was a sugar trust, a salt trust, a steel trust, even a whiskey trust. These huge corporations represented hundreds of millions of dollars. This great wealth made them very powerful. Former President Cleveland, himself a friend of business, warned of a growing danger. Corporations, he said, should be carefully controlled creatures of the law and servants of the people. Instead, they are fast becoming the people's masters.
The public began to demand government controls of the trusts. Farmers claimed that prices were too high, and they blamed the trusts. Workers said their unions could not negotiate with the new industrial giants. Small businessmen charged that trusts were too powerful. They said the trusts could destroy them. Public demands for action led the governments of 15 states to pass antitrust laws. But the state laws could do nothing. Most of the trusts were nationwide corporations, which did business in many states. public protest was so great that both parties in the 1888 elections promised to pass a federal law against trusts.
A number of such bills were proposed. One, offered by Senator John Sherman, a Republican, was approved by Congress. President Benjamin Harrison signed it into law in 1890. The Sherman antitrust law sounded severe. It said it was illegal for a trust or any other organization to interfere with interstate commerce, trade among the states. It was also illegal for any person or organization to form a monopoly, to get control of a whole industry. The law ordered harsh punishment for any person found guilty of these crimes. It sounded like a strong law, but it was not. It was written in a very general way that left the courts to decide what the law really said. Opponents of the Sherman antitrust bill said its purpose was not to destroy trusts, but to make the public believe that trusts would be destroyed.
During President Harrison's administration, only 8 corporations were accused of violating the new antitrust law. Of the 8, only 1 was found guilty, and only in a very limited way. The first company charged was the Whiskey Trust. A court dismissed the case. It said the government failed to prove that the trust had interfered with interstate commerce. A few years later, the government asked the courts to break up the huge sugar trust, which controlled 98% of the sugar-producing industry. The Supreme Court refused to do so. It said that it was true the trust had formed a monopoly in the sugar-producing industry, but it said the monopoly was in manufacturing, not in trade or interstate commerce. Therefore, said the High Court, the sugar trust was legal and did not violate the antitrust law.
Industrial trusts helped to reduce competition among American companies. High tariffs also gave some protection from competition with foreign companies. But business leaders were not satisfied. They demanded even higher taxes on imports to further reduce competition. So Republican Congressman William McKinley of Ohio proposed a new tariff bill, one that would raise import taxes higher than ever before. The tax already was about 38% on most imported products. The new measure would raise it to almost 50%.
Not everyone in the Harrison administration supported the high tariff measure. Secretary of State Blaine wanted to increase trade between the United States and other countries. He warned that new high tariffs would destroy those plans. Blaine also opposed the bill because he felt it would hurt the Republican Party politically. In a letter to Congressman McKinley, Blaine said the bill would anger the farmers by adding as much as 8% to the price of shoes for their children. Such movements as this for protection, said Blaine, will move the Republican Party only into speedy defeat.
Most Western and Southern congressmen opposed the tariff bill because it would mean higher prices to the people of their states. But the bill could not pass without the support of some of them. So supporters of the tariff bill offered a deal. If Westerners voted for the tariff measure, then Eastern lawmakers would support a silver purchase bill that the Westerners wanted. The bill, known as the Sherman Silver Purchase Act, would have the government buy 4.5 million ounces of silver each month. The government would pay for the silver with paper money, treasury notes, which could be exchanged for gold or silver money.
Western mines were producing huge amounts of silver. By selling it to the government, the mining interests hoped to keep the price of silver from falling. Western interests spoke in Congress now with a much stronger voice. In 1889 and 1890, six Western territories became states. This added 12 more Western representatives in the Senate and others in the House. The deal was agreed to. Both the McKinley Tariff Bill and the Sherman Silver Purchase Bill were approved by Congress and signed by President Harrison. As expected, the price of imported goods rose, and the people blamed the Republicans.
In the congressional elections of 1890, the Republican Party suffered heavy losses. The Republican majority in the Senate was cut to 8, and not all the Republican senators would support the party on every issue. The Republicans lost control in the House of Representatives. Only 88 were elected to House seats. Democrats elected 235 representatives. Voters also elected 9 House members and 2 senators from a new political organization, the People's Party. The new party was born in farming areas of the West and South. It was a party of protest, formed by men who refused to support either of the two old parties.
Years before, farmers had united in agricultural organizations they called granges. A national grange had been formed. During hard times, the grange organized political action groups to help elect officials who were friendly to farmers. But as farm conditions improved, the granges began to disappear. A few years later, farmers began to build new organizations. Like the granges, they began as social and economic groups. By the late 1880s, many of these groups had united into 2 large organizations. One, with more than 1 million members, was the Southern Alliance. The other, with fewer members, was the National Farmers Alliance. Members of the 2 groups began to unite for political action.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.